大家好，欢迎收看《美国之音》的时事大家谈，我是叶凡。美国疾控中心最新公布的一项新冠抗体血液抽查结果显示，将近60%的美国成年人和75%的儿童曾经感染过新冠病毒。约翰霍普金斯大学健康安全中心高级学者艾米什·阿黛尔贾博士说，这项研究结果意味着美国进入了防疫新阶段。政府的政策目标和追踪疫情的手段都发生了变化。阿黛尔贾也是美国传染病学会的发言人，他说：“新冠病毒不会消失，一个合法政府的职责不是把人们锁在家里或者在公寓外建筑围墙，而是要不计政治后果走出封城怪圈。”今天我们就邀请阿黛尔贾博士来参加时事大家谈。Dr. Adelja, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Nearly 60% of the U.S. population has antibodies due to COVID-19 infection, according to the CDC. First, can you please clarify whether this number includes people who are vaccinated?
60% figure refers to people who've had immunity from infection. Because when you test antibodies, you can test for different types of antibodies. And in this study, they look for antibodies that only would be generated from natural infection. So that 60% number has to do with what percentage of the population was infected with COVID-19. But if you're looking for total overall immunity, it's likely higher because there are going to be people who have immunity from vaccines that wasn't picked up in that study.
How long will this antibody last?
Antibodies last, so antibodies will last several months. And then they go down, and then you get re-exposed to the virus, and the antibodies go up. That's how the immune system works. And I think it's a mistake to couch everything or to weigh everything on antibody levels, because there's a whole other arm of the immune system called T cells, which are really important for preventing severe disease, hospitalization, and death. They're much harder to measure than antibodies, but I would the emphasis the over is a little bit of an overemphasis on antibodies, which has kind of led us into this booster strategy that doesn't really make sense. To be boosting everybody universally, because that's what antibodies do. They go down and they go back up. It's really about prevention of severe disease when we're talking about a virus like this, not so much about preventing mild infections in healthy people.
And also, the CDC's data shows that 75% of the children have antibodies. So, what does that mean? Because we know children under 5 are not vaccinated.
What it means is that there is a significant amount of immunity in children, that they got infected during these waves of COVID-19, and that immunity is likely going to be something that protects them even further from serious illness, hospitalization, and death. Children in general are protected from those severe consequences. This is likely going to add to that.
So, are we in the new phase of the pandemic? Have we reached the herd immunity?
We are in a new phase of the pandemic, but I wouldn't use the term herd immunity because when we use the word herd immunity, what comes to mind are diseases like measles, where we see decreased transmission because of the immunity in the population. Whereas with SARS-CoV-2, what we see is immunity against serious illness, hospitalization, and death increasing, even though we don't get immunity to infection, because this virus comes from a family of viruses that are able to reinfect us, that are able to evade immunity. So herd immunity doesn't mean the same thing for coronaviruses that it does for measles. And I think the goal here has to be to decouple hospitalizations from cases. And that's clearly what we're seeing as cases are going up right now, but we don't see hospitals overwhelmed because so many people have immunity, not against infection, but against serious illness, hospitalization, and death.
So, what is the new policy goal in this phase?
To me, the new policy goal should be to make sure that we are using all the tools that we have to keep people out of the hospital, which means antivirals, monoclonal antibodies, rapid tests, so that we can keep these cases from turning into major issues for hospitals. And increasingly, that's going to be the case regardless because we've got so much immunity in the population. But I think what we need to do is continue to make more tools and continue to minimize the death and hospitalizations that occur from COVID-19. But there's always going to be a baseline number of cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. And I think our policy goal really needs to reflect the fact that this is an endemic virus, and our goal is to make it more manageable, more like other respiratory viruses we deal with year in and year out.
Could you please elaborate on the tools and the measures to minimize the impact of the pandemic?
The tools that we have are several. Vaccines are the biggest one. We know that vaccines are really instrumental in preventing serious disease. We also have monoclonal antibodies, both for treatment and for prevention. Those need to be scaled up and much more available. And we have antivirals like Paxlovid, which can keep people out of the hospital. That needs to be something that people can readily get very quickly without having to go through a hassle of getting a prescription and trying to find a prescription because you just have 5 days to get it. And the other is rapid tests. Rapid tests, people are able to know their status, know if they're contagious, know if they need if they need to have antiviral therapy. All of that's going to be key with rapid tests. So I think those are the main tools that we have. But the biggest tool I think we have is knowledge. Knowledge of how this virus spreads, knowledge of its complications, knowledge of how to treat it, all of that also plays a major role in how manageable this has become.
According to this data, the average daily number of COVID-19 cases in the U.S. is about 57,000 in the past week. Meanwhile, the country has recorded about a five-fold drop in PCR testing since the Omicron peak. So how reliable is the current case numbers?
Well, we know that those case numbers are an underestimate because many people are taking advantage of the fact that we have home tests that are available for diagnosis. And I think that's great that people are using home tests. And at this stage of the pandemic, I don't think that the daily case count makes much of a difference. I think we're much more focused on hospitalizations and deaths in the United States, and those are the numbers that matter. But we know that those 57,000 cases are not the full representative sample of how many people have COVID-19. It's probably a lot higher than that. But the thing is, we are less focused on cases in the United States and now much more focused on hospitalizations, deaths, and I think those metrics are much more solid because they're reported from hospitals and not necessarily subject to the same limitations as testing numbers are.
But people are still wondering what the new metrics we use to let us know what's happening now. How do we know how many cases, if my neighbors, my friends are infected?
Well, I think that the best metrics now are going to be numbers of people in the hospital and what the hospital capacity is. We can also look at things like the sanitation samples, looking at wastewater sampling to see, is it going up, is it going down? How does it compare to what it was a week ago? That can help gauge what's going on in terms of transmission. But remember that there's always going to be cases and they're going to go up and down. It's really not something that is going to ever go to zero. But I think what you can do is look at wastewater sampling. You can look at your hospitals. You can look at your circle of individuals, who's getting infected, who's not getting infected, to sort of gauge your individual risk. But I don't think that daily case counts are the best way to do this at this point.
Are you worried if the virus continues to spread, it will keep mutating and there will be new variants?
This virus is always going to spread. It can't be eradicated. It can't be eliminated. And we are going to see more variants. That's just the norm. The coronaviruses evolve to be able to get around our immunity, and that's what we're going to see because we're never going to get cases down to zero because this isn't a virus that you can do that with because anytime there's social interaction, the virus has an opportunity to spread. Our goal is to be really aware of the variants as they occur and meet them with new tools, with new knowledge, and I think that's what we have to really keep in mind. And even though people are worried about variants, it's going to be very unlikely that a variant can erase everything that our immunity does for us. Meaning, yes, variants might come just like BA2 and be able to reinfect us, but they're unlikely to be able to cause severe disease on a wide scale if the population is heavily immune to COVID-19 more generally.
While on the other side of the world, there are large Omicron outbreaks in China, a citywide lockdown in Shanghai and potentially in Beijing, is raising questions about how much longer the zero COVID approach can sustain. China is stuck in a cycle of COVID lockdowns. Is there a path for them to move forward?
The path would be for them to actually recognize the science of this virus and realize that COVID zero is not a sustainable policy. It never was a rational policy with a virus like this. China's way out is to vaccinate their elderly population, to use mRNA vaccines that were made in the United States, which have been shown to be very effective, and to really come up with an approach that isn't abstinence only, that really teaches people how to risk calculate and gets away from these blunt tools like lockdowns, which violate individual rights, and use tools like the vaccine and realize that this isn't going to be a virus that ever goes away. COVID zero will have to go on forever if with a virus like this, and China would not be able to socially interact with anyone if this is the policy that they have in place. They really need to cut their ties to COVID zero and really not worry about the political ramifications, because scientifically speaking, their policy is a failure and they should be held accountable for it by their own population.
But the Chinese government's excuse is that if they abandon the zero COVID policy now, the number of infection cases will surge and the health system will be paralyzed. How can China get out of this dilemma?
Well, China's had over 2 years to figure this out. And what they failed to do is the most important thing, and that is vaccinate their high-risk population. It's really inexcusable that they have not done that, or that they have not used the best vaccines that are available to them. They have badmouthed the mRNA vaccines. They have resisted attempts to use the mRNA vaccines for Pfizer and Moderna, which have been instrumental in controlling this virus. So they are in a bad dilemma, but it's a dilemma of their own government's creation. This was their choice. This was their leadership's choice to take this approach. And now they are stuck with a virus that can't be eliminated and a high-risk population that is not immune and a healthcare system that is held hostage by that situation. But who they have to blame is their own leadership. Their own leadership led them into this.
China criticized the approach of living with COVID is diminishing government's commitment to tracking and responding to the pandemic, which could leave countries flying blind and unprepared for any new variant. So what is your response? What is the role of the government in the new phase of living with COVID?
To me, the government's role is about making sure that people are not infecting other people by working with isolation and quarantine rules for people that are actually exposed, but also using that with the best science that's available and not using blunt tools, but really precision-guided tools to help people with isolation, to help people with quarantine. The government's role is not to lock people in their houses, to not build fences around apartments, to not take children from their parents. That's not the role of any kind of legitimate government. So I think you have to really restrict the government to prevention of infection using precision-guided tools that are really based on risk and based on science. So, for example, you wouldn't be treating outdoor activities the same as indoor activities. Yet in China, they do treat outdoor activities the same as indoor activities. That's not justified. So what I would see, what China has done with their government is it's a huge role for the government that has usurped the individual rights of the population. And I think there is a right size and a right role for government here, but it's surely not the Chinese way.
So as we're moving into living with COVID as an individual, how should we prevent infection? How many booster shots of vaccine should we have?
COVID-19 infection is inevitable. This is a virus that everybody is going to deal with at some point. The goal is to get it when you're vaccinated so that it is mild. Booster vaccinations, what they should be used for are to prevent serious illness, hospitalization, and death. So I think booster vaccinations are best targeted to people that have high-risk conditions. I've never been in favor of universal boosting because I think that that's not the best strategy with these first-generation vaccines. I don't think that boosting healthy people to prevent mild illness makes much sense. I think what we want to do is target boosters to places where we see serious illness occurring after vaccination, and that might be in people who are older, people with high-risk conditions. But it's important for the world to recognize that this is a virus that everyone will have experience with because it's not going to be eradicated or eliminated. It comes from a family of viruses that cause about 30% of our common colds. This is going to be the fifth seasonal coronavirus, and the goal is to make it milder, and that's what our vaccines, our antivirals, and our monoclonal antibodies do.
So besides government policies and all these measures, treatments, and vaccines, to live with COVID requires a huge mental shift and acceptance of manageable risk in our lives. Could you explain what kind of behaviors, attitude, and social norms we should adapt?
Well, the first thing is to recognize that the post-pandemic world is not going to be 2019. It's going to be a world in which COVID-19 is present. In any social interaction that someone has is going to have some risk of COVID-19, just like it has always had some risk of respiratory viral infection. That's the price we pay when we live in cities and we live amongst other individuals, that there are certain infectious diseases that are going to become more common. And that's what people have to come to grips with. And it's very hard for many people because for so long during the pandemic, we were in what I would call an abstinence-only approach where people were somehow thinking that they could wait this out and eventually the pandemic would disappear the way a hurricane disappears. But that's not the case. This is an endemic infection. So what people have to do is think about their risk factors for severe disease and think about their risk calculation. Think about what activities they're doing and whether it's worth it or whether it's not worth it, whether they want to wear a mask, whether they don't, whether they want people to be tested, whether they don't. It's not going to be the same for everyone. It's just like it is for during influenza season. Each person makes their own risk calculations, and that's where we're going with this virus because we will never be back to 2019. We will never be to a COVID-free world. So people have to learn how to risk calculate and realize that anytime they socially interact, there's always going to be some level of COVID risk. It's always going to be greater than zero.
As we move forward, there will still be many challenges such as long COVID. How much of a burden could it bring to our healthcare system?
We have a lot to learn about long COVID. It clearly is something that happens in a proportion of patients who have COVID-19. But what we need to do is really understand what the definition is, what the actual diagnostic criteria are for long COVID before we can really get a handle on what the burden will be. But it will be a significant burden going forward. But the thing is about long COVID, it is much less likely to happen if somebody has been vaccinated. So one of the ways to prevent long COVID from occurring is making sure more and more people are vaccinated so that their COVID infection does not lead to long COVID. But this will be one of the long tails of the pandemic that we're going to need to learn a lot more about.
非常感谢约翰霍普金斯大学健康安全中心高级学者艾米什·阿丹尔贾博士的分析和解答。来宾发表的都是个人意见，并不一定代表美国之音。感谢您收看《时事大家谈》，我是叶凡，下次节目再会。